Little Amal, a giant puppet depicting a young Syrian refugee child, has arrived in St. Peter's Square in Vatican City. This 3.5 meter tall puppet has traveled all the way from Syria to Turkey, Greece and Italy. It will then go to France, Switzerland, Germany, Belgium and the UK to focus attention on the urgent needs of young refugees. Syrian refugees, especially children, are in a dire situation after being driven from their homes due to the conflict in their country. Archaeologists have discovered the largest ever bronze mask in an archaeological site in China's southwest Sichuan province.
This is a large bronze mask we unearthed from the central park of the number 3 ritual pit. The widest part, from one tip of ear to the other, is 136 centimeters, and the height is around 75 centimeters. It can be regarded as the largest bronze mask unearthed in Sanjingdui, and even the largest in the Shang and the Shu dynasties.
The mask was found together with other cultural objects such as ivory and bronzeware. These items needed to be removed first before handling the mask, which made the extraction process complicated. Restoration work is underway on the largest bronze mask taken from the site. The relic is believed to be thousands of years old, dating back to the Shu period. The site is an archaeological treasure mine belonging to the Bronze Age of over 4,000 years ago. The area was first discovered in China in the late 1920s. An Australian zoo has welcomed two baby bilbies, an endangered species. Their birth has brought joy and hope to zookeepers and wildlife enthusiasts. The baby bilbies were born in Taronga Zoo in Western Sydney. Zookeepers named the two male joeys, Molly and Cliff, after a national park that once was home to herds of this animal. The birth of the joeys has raised hope among the zookeepers of reintroducing the species to the wild. Bilbies were once found across 70% of Australia's landmass. They are believed to have inhabited Australia for up to 15 million years.
Chameleons changing color is one of the most fascinating traits amongst living creatures. Now, can't humans make a robot with the same capability? In a science lab in Seoul, a team of engineers have created a robot that mimics the color-changing ability of the famous lizard. The researchers have made the skin with a special ink that changes color based on temperature and is controlled by tiny flexible heaters. The head engineer says, creating a wearable device that can actively change color and patterns was the main goal of the study.
The pattern of South Korea's military uniform is made for woodland and certain colors. So if you wear this military uniform and go to the desert, you can be easily exposed. Actively changing colors and patterns to match different surroundings is the key of camouflage technology, and we made this possible.
The total thickness of the flexible, multi-layered artificial skin is thinner than a human hair. The scientists envision that their research can be adapted for military uniforms to help soldiers blend into their surroundings. It can also be used for aesthetic purposes such as fashion, exterior of cars and buildings, as well as future display technology.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Infuriated human rights advocates have recently denounced the Biden administration for resuming deportation flights to Haiti, even as residents of the impoverished Caribbean nation continue to struggle in the aftermath of last month's disastrous earthquake and tropical storm, which came amid the COVID-19 pandemic and in the wake of an ongoing political economic crisis. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Cruel and Callous, Biden Slammed for Resuming Deportations to Battered Haiti. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Infuriated human rights advocates recently denounced the Biden administration for resuming deportation flights to Haiti, even as residents of the impoverished Caribbean nation continue to struggle in the aftermath of last month's disastrous earthquake and tropical storm, which came amid the COVID-19 pandemic and in the wake of an ongoing political economic crisis. Geraldine Joseph, co-founder and executive director of the Haitian Bridge Alliance, told The Hill, "We are in utter disbelief that the Biden administration would deport Haitians now." Hours after the 7.2 magnitude earthquake, President Joe Biden released a statement saying that the United States was a friend of Haiti. A friend does not continuously inflict pain on another friend. And yet today, just 1 month after this devastating earthquake and storm that resulted in the death of over 2,200 Haitians, injured 12,000 people, damaged or destroyed 120,000 homes, and displaced hundreds of thousands of people, the administration sent a plane full of families to Haiti under Title 42, including children under the age of 3, without offering them legal protection and opportunity to file for asylum, added Joseph. Despite the pleas of immigration rights advocates who last month asked the Department of Homeland Security, DHS, to halt deportations to Haiti and extend the eligibility date for temporary protection status, that is TPS benefits, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, reportedly expelled 86 Haitians from the U.S., banishing them to a country where clean water, food, shelter, and coronavirus vaccines, among other life-saving necessities, are immensely difficult to obtain. That ICE would continue to carry out the mass deportations for Haitian neighbors, with Haiti in the midst of its worst political, public health, and economic crises yet, is cruel and callous, Representative Ayanna Pressley told The Hill. In May, DHS permitted Haitians currently residing in the United States as of May 21, 2021, to file initial applications for TPS so long as they meet eligibility requirements. Recipients are allowed to live and work in the U.S. without risk of deportation for 18 months. Following the assassination of former President Jovenel Moïse on July 7th, DHS expanded Haiti's TPS designation to include Haitians living in the U.S. as of July 29, 2021. However, a week after Moïse was killed, DHS Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas announced that Haitian migrants who attempt to travel to the U.S. via boat would be intercepted by the Coast Guard and either turned back or sent to a third country for resettlement. Although TPS designation could protect up to 150,000 Haitians from deportation, potentially thousands of Haitian immigrants entered the U.S. after the July 29th deadline or are stuck in Mexican border cities. Those who make it to the U.S. are at risk of expulsion, with no opportunity to request asylum under Title 42. First invoked in March 2020 by former President Donald Trump during the early stages of the coronavirus pandemic, Title 42 is an obscure 77-year-old public health law that the Trump administration used in an effort to close off the southern U.S. border, effectively denying tens of thousands of vulnerable people the right to seek asylum. While the Biden administration has continued the harmful policy deporting hundreds of thousands of individuals, including Haitians, under Title 42 as well as another expedited removal procedure, a federal judge recently ordered the White House to end its use of the public health provision following a lawsuit filed by human rights groups.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo Jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The Israeli regime has reportedly started a cyber sabotage campaign in the UAE to interfere with the regional air and maritime navigation in West Asia.
Cyber warfare is becoming more and more important and more dangerous as well. So Israel wants to take advantage of any opportunities there.
The campaign seeks to disrupt the Persian Gulf and the Sea of Oman region's air and maritime navigation systems, thus destabilizing the regional security situation. On the other hand, the bid seeks to transit the focal point of crisis away from the occupied territories towards the region and therefore reduce the political and security pressure faced by the regime's ruling body. The UAE has signed dozens of memorandums of understanding with Israel since it became the first Arab state to normalize ties with Israel this century.
Israel sees itself with the Sunni monarchies and the conservatives as their potential allies in this. So it wants to be able to conduct the kind of cyber sabotage and infiltration that is becoming so important, so much more important. So it's not surprising that they would do this when they have the opportunity, and the UAE is providing that opportunity for them.
Israel has said that it expects $1 billion in trade with the UAE by the end of 2021, and $3 billion in 3 years. The UAE aims to raise the value of economic activity with Israel to more than $1 trillion in the next 10 years. According to regional observers, at the heart of the UAE's desire to normalize ties with the regime in Tel Aviv was its penchant for U.S.-made F-35 fighter jets, which the peace deals with Israel, known as the Abraham Accords, made possible. After the Persian Gulf state established full diplomatic relations with the Tel Aviv regime in a deal brokered by the former U.S. President Donald Trump. Shortly after the deal was reached, the Trump administration authorized the sale of 50 advanced F-35 fighter jets to the UAE. The UAE and Israel are reportedly deepening their ties and espionage activities in the region. The UAE has helped Israel set up a center for military and maritime reconnaissance on the strategic Yemeni island of Socotra. The Red Crescent Society of the United Arab Emirates has signed a contract with the Tel Aviv regime in order to create an intelligence center for the Israeli Air Force at Socotra Airport. Socotra is home to some 60,000 people. It overlooks the Bab el-Mandab Strait, a main shipping route that connects the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden and the Arabian Sea. It also has a unique ecosystem, which is already being exploited by the Emiratis. The mission reportedly aimed at collecting information from across the Gulf of Aden, including Bab el-Mandab and south of Yemen, which is under the control of forces backed by the UAE. Socotra has been a source of tensions between the UAE and Saudi Arabia. They have been jockeying for position for control of the island's unique resources in the absence of a powerful government in Yemen amid a ferocious war on the country. Back in June 2020, UAE-backed separatists of the so-called Southern Transitional Council, or the STC, took control of Socotra.
As you know, Israel has always welcomed the opportunity to have alliances within what it has considered to be the enemy camp, namely the Arabs. And in the opportunity with an alliance is to profit in various ways, to build one's power through espionage.
A new security pact involving the United States, Britain, and Australia has triggered controversy and condemnation. The U.S. and U.K. announced this week that they will provide Australia with advanced technology to build nuclear-powered submarines. Based on their agreement, Australian naval forces will have atomic submarines that are much faster as they use nuclear propulsion systems and harder to detect than conventional fleets. They can spend months under the sea and target longer distances with their missiles. The leaders of the three countries hailed the New Deal as a step that will make it easier to counter threats in the Indo-Pacific. They repeatedly mentioned regional security concerns, which they said had grown significantly. None of them mentioned China, but the pact is being widely viewed as an initiative to counter Chinese influence in the region, including in the contested resource-rich South China Sea.
Well, there are two elements here. One is the fact that this alliance could be a new version of NATO for Indo-Pacific region, and the other is that this purchase of nuclear-powered submarine could be an initial step to transfer more technology to nuclear technology to Australia, maybe in the long term having Australia acquiring nuclear bomb capacity.
The United States and its allies make no secret of their intensified efforts to try to contain the growing Chinese influence and power there. Many observers believe the newly announced deal is in line with those efforts. Meanwhile, the development is expected to further sour relations between Beijing and Canberra. In recent years, political tensions have grown between the two over a number of issues, including Australia's stance against Chinese telecom giant Huawei. Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman Xiao Lijian criticized what he called the U.S.-led alliance's obsolete Cold War mentality and warned the three countries against moves that would hurt their own interests. Some Chinese media went so far as to say that Australia had now turned itself into an adversary of China. What are the implications of this new pact and other moves against China for regional and international security? Meanwhile, China was not the only party infuriated by the new security pact. France condemned it too. That is because Australia will now scrap a deal with France to buy a dozen conventional submarines worth tens of billions of dollars. France's Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called Australia's agreement with the US and the UK a stab in the back. France said the development underscored the need to bolster a, quote, European strategic autonomy. The United States and arch-rival China may have toned down their rhetoric against each other, but tensions between the two superpowers are simmering as they remain deeply engaged in an intense global rivalry. There are many flashpoints in their testy relationship, including tensions in the South China Sea and the issue of Taiwan. America has made it clear that its military will maintain a strong presence in the Indo-Pacific, where the U.S. has been trying to contain the growing influence of its arch-rival. America seems determined to follow policies aimed at containing the Chinese influence worldwide. And with China absolutely unwilling to back down, tensions are expected to mount in the coming years.
The political climate created by the global war on terror after the 9/11 attacks set the stage for large increases in the Pentagon budget, much of which went to military contractors. A new article by Brown University's Cost of War Project has shed light on military spending by the Pentagon after 9/11. The Pentagon budget increased by over 10% in the first year after the 9/11 attacks and the commencement of the war in Afghanistan. The Pentagon budget untimely increased year after year for 10 years running and peaked in 2010 at the highest level since World War II.
President Eisenhower, when he was leaving office, talked about the military-industrial complex, and these are the people that supply the weapons for wars. And in order to have a war, you have to have some type of threat, and that was provided by 9/11, and they decided to cash in on that. This provided unique opportunities for stealing money.
The study says over $14 trillion was spent by the Pentagon since the start of the war in Afghanistan. The report says $4.4 trillion of the total spending went towards weapons procurement and research and development. That category directly benefited corporate military contractors. Out of the $4.4 trillion, the top five U.S. weapons makers, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and Northrop Grumman, received $2.2 trillion, almost half. Besides getting paid for weapons and research, U.S. corporations profit from private contractors that are deployed to war zones. The most notorious private security contractor previously employed by the Pentagon is Blackwater. It is a mercenary group whose employees massacred 17 people in Iraq's Nasser Square back in 2007. The Pentagon also employed private contractors for just about every task in U.S. war zones. At the end of the Trump administration, only 2,500 U.S. troops were left in Afghanistan, but over 18,000 Pentagon contractors were still in the country.
And what we saw recently was that they were, a lot of those weapons that got left behind were delivered within weeks of the end of the war. I mean, very close to pulling out. which meant that they had to unload them in order to cash in on what they were doing. They also unloaded them into a group of people who could use them to destabilize the region, which was also their intent.
The report explained how China is the new justification for military spending. As the US has reduced the size of its military footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan, exaggerated estimates of the military challenges allegedly posed by China have become the new rationale of choice in arguments for keeping the Pentagon budget at historically high levels. The most likely impact of the shift towards China will be to further tighten the grip of major weapons makers like Northrop Grumman, Lockheed Martin, General Dynamics, and Raytheon Technologies on the Pentagon budget. Over the past few years, the US has adopted a confrontational approach toward China. There are many contentious issues the two countries have been quarreling over.
China is much more complicated because both countries, China and the United States, are tied together economically in a way that would be very difficult to disentangle over, in short notice. The United States is dependent on China for a large bulk of its manufacturers, including crucial manufacturers like computer chips.
The U.S. accuses China of genocide against the Uyghur population in the province of Xinjiang. China has rejected the accusations, asking the U.S. to stop interfering in what Beijing considers its internal affairs. The two countries have also been locked in a trade dispute since 2018, when the Trump administration imposed tariffs on more than $360 billion of Chinese goods, and China retaliated with tariffs on more than $110 billion of US products. US meddling in the South China Sea and provocative speeches by US officials have also angered China, with Beijing accusing Washington of being the direct driver of tensions in the region.
On Sunday, North Korea said it has successfully test-fired a new long-range cruise missile over the weekend, the first missile launch by the country since March. According to North Korea's official news agency, KCNA, the missiles deployed during the test flew 1,500 kilometers before hitting their designated targets inside the country's territorial waters. In response, the United States military accused North Korea of posing threats to Pyongyang's regional neighbors and the international community. The North Korean outlet, however, described the new missile as having strategic significance, which will help the country counter aggression from foreign forces. The announcement has led experts to speculate that the missiles are nuclear capable, but so far, it's unclear whether Pyongyang has perfected the technology needed to make warheads small enough to fit into cruise missiles.
The new technique and strategy has been sanctions, has been chastising DPRK for having a defensive nuclear program that has never been launched. It's not the DPRK that has launched nuclear war against Japan. They didn't launch the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was the U.S. imperialists who did so.
The agency called the weapon a key element in a five-year plan outlined in January to further advance the nuclear-armed country's defense science and arsenals. It added that the development of the most recently tested missiles took 2 years to complete. Former U.S. President Donald Trump took an unusual approach in his North Korea policy. He began his tenure by issuing threats, warning Pyongyang of, quote, fire and fury.
He has been very threatening beyond a normal statement. And as I said, they will be met with fire, fury, and frankly, power, the likes of which this world has never seen before.
In June 2018, however, Trump met North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in Singapore, an event that marked the first ever meeting between the two countries' leaders. The two officials met once again in Hanoi, Vietnam, in February 2019 to discuss denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and the lifting of U.S. sanctions, as well as a halt to joint military exercises conducted by Washington and its allies near North Korea, maneuvers that Pyongyang considers provocative and a national security threat. The summit, however, broke down without any tangible results. In the meantime, ties between China and the U.S. deteriorated since the president took office in 2016. The Trump administration took the country into a trade war with China, imposing billions of dollars worth of tariffs on Chinese imports.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
Trump's anti-China rhetoric escalated after the COVID-19 pandemic broke out, worsening the already frigid ties between Washington and Beijing. Many observers expected the Biden era to mark a departure from Trump's hawkish policies. Weeks into his presidency, however, the Biden administration announced new sanctions against China and threatened North Korea with military action.
Under the Biden administration, we're not going to see much headway into peace between the DPRK and the U.S., because ultimately what this comes down to is China. The U.S. wants to colonize and expand its presence on the Korean Peninsula to annex North Korea DPRK so that it can use it as a base of aggression and platform against China.
It appears that Biden has chosen the same approach toward countries the U.S. deems as its adversaries as Trump did. But wouldn't the same approach to solving a problem always produce the same result?
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the U.S. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Lee Haedong, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Defective Electoral System is Losing Its Appeal. Stay tuned for more. Since the unrest at the U.S. Capitol, social chaos in the U.S. has gradually calmed down, but the U.S. public has increasingly doubted the Biden administration's ability to govern their country due to its poor performance handling both domestic and foreign affairs. This has reignited suspicion among Republican political elites and Donald Trump's supporters that the election was stolen. According to the latest poll done by CNN, among Republicans, 78% say that Biden did not win, while 54% believe that there is solid evidence of that, even though no such evidence has been made public. Questions about the outcome of last year's presidential election have been amplified again, reflecting the unbridgeable gap between U.S. political elites and everyday voters. Biden's attempts to narrow the U.S. deep political divisions will fail. The upcoming rally will unleash a new wave of political defamation in the U.S. Trump supporters are not going to the streets to heal U.S. divisions or put their country back on the right track. On the contrary, it is a campaign boost for Trump or the populist wing of the Republican Party, so that Republicans can regain some of their advantages in the next year's midterm elections. The CNN poll also said that 56% of Americans think democracy in the U.S. is under attack. Ever since the 2016 U.S. presidential election, people's impression of the U.S. election system can be summarized using one word: ridiculous. Elections are no longer about addressing macro solutions to the country's challenges. Instead, they are about name-calling, cursing, and denigrating candidates and their supporters. The U.S. presidential election in 2016 between Trump and Hillary Clinton was a campaign of personal aggression that reflected the hideous side of American democratic practice. The practical election in 2020 once again proved that U.S. politics are not about solving problems. Trump was voted out from the U.S. presidency, as many expected. However, after Trump left office, there has been no way for the U.S. system to hold former U.S. officials accountable for their failure to control the COVID-19 epidemic. Instead, those politicians who created this very tragedy at home continue to do nothing to help with the epidemic control. In fact, they keep using COVID-19 to gain political capital for themselves. This reveals the quality of U.S. electoral politics is so low that many of those elected are clowns who care for nothing but their own interest. It seems that the U.S. electoral system is falling apart after more than 200 years. U.S. democracy has indeed reached a dead end. It is unable to clean its ocean stables. This is undoubtedly a tragedy for the United States. According to the CNN poll, 51% of Americans believe it is likely that elected officials in the U.S. will successfully overturn the results of a future election because their party did not win. As for the series of changes to voting rules and regulations at the state level, 25% of Americans say both parties are acting in their own best interest. And just 12% say that both sides are acting to make elections fairer. The American electoral system revolves around party politics, so it is difficult to avoid interference from partisan struggles. U.S. politicians participate in elections to guarantee their future political career and the governance of their party. This is completely contrary to the focus of the U.S. political system when it was first established to defend national security and seek development and interest for the people. This shows the U.S. should really start to rethink about how to adjust and reform its political system, but indeed, it is very hard for the U.S. to do so now. the internet era, the U.S. ridiculous electoral politics and deep opposition among U.S. voters are broadcast to the wider world. If even American people do not accept the outcome of their election in the future, then no one would believe the U.S. when it brags about its own merits. In the past, people might believe that the U.S. politics could gradually overcome its own shortcomings. But it turns out these shortcomings have instead become stubborn problems that cannot be overcome. The U.S. system is losing its appeal and more.
Communique. It's been 20 years now since the terrorist attacks of September the 11th, which killed 3,000 Americans, saw the World Trade Centers collapse, the Pentagon on fire, and another plane lost. A violent tragedy, which was a pretext to start not just a war in Afghanistan, but an entire war on terror, spanning multiple continents, killing scores of innocents and displacing millions. Almost 20 years to the day, the United States has finally left Afghanistan. While the media fixates obsessively over the withdrawal, what about the war itself? If America started an entire war in order to fight terrorism, shouldn't we be asking whether it worked? Did the United States actually defeat terrorism, or did it make it worse? What could possibly justify occupying another country for 20 years, killing hundreds of thousands, and displacing millions more? This is what we should be asking. It's the only sensible, rational thing to do. But no one seems to be asking the question, so we will. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. It's been 20 years now since the attacks of September the 11th, a tragic event that left 3,000 Americans dead and the world in shock. What was at first an awful terrorist attack was soon to become the catalyst for war. U.S. President George Bush, along with his British counterpart Tony Blair, used the pretext of 9/11 to attack and invade Afghanistan, which they called the War on Terror. Now, of course, in 2021, they try to justify the invasion by saying, oh, it was good for women's rights, and we were nation-building, and oh, democracy. But back then, these terms weren't even heard of. The phrase nation-building or women's rights wasn't in the conversation in 2001. Back then, what they said was, we have to go to Afghanistan and get bin Laden and get Al-Qaeda and get the Taliban because they sheltered bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. And to do this, the U.S. Congress passed something called the AUMF of 2001, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force. Now, the AUMF doesn't even specifically mention Afghanistan or Al-Qaeda or bin Laden or the Taliban. The AUMF only refers to those who attacked America or helped attack America on 9/11. It's 1.5 pages long and extremely vague. It talks about an abstract, undefined enemy whose name we don't know. We don't know where they live. They use these broad blanket terms on purpose. You know, just conveniently, it's an abstract enemy, an open-ended war that can't be finished, just like the war on drugs. And every single person in Congress voted for this, barely a week after 9/11, with the exception of Barbara Lee. And so after 9/11 happened, the Taliban actually offered to hand over bin Laden. They told the U.S., here, we'll give bin Laden to a third country if you can prove that he's guilty first, which is basic rule of law. It's a minimum requirement for an extradition. But the U.S. said no. They refused multiple times. So what does that tell you about their intentions? I mean, if you're going to go to war because you're so sure that it was bin Laden, then surely you can prove that he's guilty, right? That should be easy. If you can occupy Afghanistan for years, then you can surely make the effort to extradite him. But they didn't. They were clearly adamant to just go in and bomb Afghanistan and occupy it. This was a chance to avoid war, and Bush did not take it. And just 1 month after the invasion, Tony Blair claimed Al-Qaeda was destroyed. All the infrastructure was gone. Okay, well, if the goal of the war on terror was to defeat Al-Qaeda, then why did you stay for 20 years? This shows you that they are occupiers. Either Tony Blair was lying, or for once, he was being honest. and admitting that they were staying in Afghanistan for very different reasons than just going after Al-Qaeda. Because after they got rid of Al-Qaeda, now all of a sudden the enemy is the Taliban. And it's not just the Taliban, oh, they have to stay for nation building and women's rights and you name it. They find every reason under the sun to justify imperialism. And one of the real reasons that they stayed in Afghanistan, besides making money, was that they wanted a military presence at Iran and China's doorstep. And now all of a sudden, Iran has U.S. bases to the east on its border with Afghanistan. It's got U.S. bases to the north, and then U.S. bases in the west after the invasion of Iraq in 2003. Very practical, right, to have American bases on Iran's border and China's border without actually invading them, but just close enough to intimidate them. Now, if we talk about the war on terror, there's one important question to ask. How successful was this war on terror? If the goal was to defeat terrorism, well, then it was a failure, a disaster. Because ever since they started the war on terror, there have been more suicide attacks, more terrorism, and not just more in general, but there are more people dying from these terrorist attacks. And where are these people dying? In the countries where America claims it is fighting terrorism. I mean, either America is helping fuel the rise of terrorism, or it is so incompetent and dangerous that it is inadvertently causing more terrorism. And either way, the conclusion, the logical conclusion from this is that you should not be invading other people's country. It is undeniable. The West invading other countries is not a force for good in the world. It is making the world more dangerous. Before the invasion in 2001, Al-Qaeda was supposedly just confined to Afghanistan. Well, now you apparently have Al-Qaeda in Yemen, in Iraq, in Syria, in sub-Saharan Africa. And now you have different flavors of Daesh. But instead of admitting this and asking the hard questions, the media is just turning around and burying its head in the sand and focusing on the withdrawal. And even during the pullout by U.S. troops, what happens? A terrorist attack. 170 people tragically killed at Kabul airport. I mean, nothing is more emblematic of what a failure this entire campaign has been. And this isn't something just confined to Afghanistan, as they went and implicated Iraq into this mess with this absurd lie about Saddam Hussein having links to Al-Qaeda, even claiming that he wanted to give Al-Qaeda nuclear weapons. So after they invaded Afghanistan under this pretext of fighting terrorism, then they invaded Iraq, even though both these countries had nothing to do with 9/11. All that was necessary was to seemingly claim a link to Al-Qaeda. That's all they had to do. And that's why the AUMF has been used in at least 19 countries to bomb 19 countries. And this hasn't just happened under Bush. This is something that has been pursued by every president. Obama massively expanded the U.S. drone strike program. Under Trump, airstrikes increased by 432%. Just this month, a drone strike ordered by President Biden killed an entire family in Afghanistan. Now you have all these people dying from terrorism, from new variants of Al-Qaeda, of Daesh, all these attacks on the rise. And those people who weren't killed by the terrorists were killed by the Americans, by the coalition of the willing, by state terrorism. And if you look at Afghanistan, 50,000 dead. And that's a conservative estimate. Pakistan, where the war spilled over to, lost masses of people because of U.S. drone strikes. And then the figure is really in the hundreds of thousands. But it doesn't end there. 1 million Iraqis dead, not to mention the millions of refugees, half of Syria's population displaced. You know, 3,000 people died on 9/11. How many 9/11s has Afghanistan had? How many 9/11s has Iraq had? How many 9/11s have Pakistan, Syria, Somalia, Yemen, Libya? How many have they had? Or are you going to come here and tell me that 3,000 Americans are worth more than millions of Arabs and Muslims? Are you telling me that it's okay to kill millions of Muslims and Arabs to avenge 3,000 Americans? Without a doubt, the real victims of the war on terror are surely those whose countries were invaded. Joining me is British political activist Chris Nynham. He is a founding member of the Stop the War Coalition, an advocacy group for peace and against interventionism. Chris was one of the organizers of the protest on 15th of February 2003, where masses of people poured into the streets voicing their opposition against the invasion of Iraq. It has been claimed as the largest public demonstration in British history. He also served under former Labour Party leader Jeremy Corbyn. So, Chris, you know, it's the 20th anniversary. We're 20 years on now from 9/11. We've had the war on terror, so much conflict. Could I just get your thoughts very briefly on this 20th anniversary of this terrible attack and everything that's happened since then?
I think both the attack itself, which was a tragedy, and the response from the West have been absolutely catastrophic. I mean, the world has changed in the last 20 years very, very profoundly. And that's mainly because the kind of response to 9/11 that was charted by the US administration under Bush has been catastrophically bad. The whole idea of invading a country in order to liberate it, to change it, to bring progress, is a completely faulty one. It's been, in terms of particularly Western foreign policy, it's been an absolutely catastrophic 20 years.
One of the things that I remember from when I was a kid, and this has always stayed in my memory, is the February 15th protest, you know, seeing millions of people from around the world, as you just mentioned, and especially in the UK, flooding the streets. If I'm not mistaken, you helped organize this protest, right? And so I wanted to ask you, I mean, what does it take to sustain a movement like that, to keep a sentiment of anti-war, anti-imperialism going in the public, and how important is it to have public opinion against the wars in the first place?
There were a number of different elements to building a movement. First of all, it was trying to establish the broadest possible kind of coalition of forces, which meant getting, obviously, people from the left, campaigning hard to get the unions on board, which is something we managed to do, most of the trade unions in Britain, starting with the more militant unions, but gradually kind of pushing outwards from that base. Crucially, the Muslim communities in Britain, we approached, sometimes they approached us. We worked very, very closely together with them, and that was very important in terms of even the first demonstration in November, November 2001, there was a large number of people from, you know, the Muslim communities in Britain on the demonstration, which was a very, very powerful statement. I think it had a big effect on people.
You recently wrote an article, I think, in the Morning Star about the 20-year anniversary of 9/11, and you mentioned that, quote, supporters of the invasion claim that there were advances in the country under occupation, but that the facts suggest otherwise. Can you give us some examples of that?
Well, I mean, the two things that are commonly said by defenders of the war, apologists for the war in Afghanistan, are that there was a health service that was built up that was, you know, a massive improvement, and B, that women's lives have improved. And I think really, fundamentally, neither thing is true. I mean, Afghanistan spends 0.6 of its percent of its GDP on health, which is one of the lowest percentages anywhere in the world, and stands against an average in South Asia of 5%. So, I mean, health provision is absolutely diabolical in the country. That's the truth. And secondly, on the issue of advances for women, I think there were some advances for women in more middle class or elite circles in the cities, but in general, life for women in Afghanistan has been as bad, if not worse, as it has for everyone else. I mean, 240,000 people have been killed by the war, to start with, but also the devastation of the infrastructure, the general violence and lawlessness in the country. All of these things have impacted massively on women's lives. And actually, if you look at the stats, the levels of literacy for women in Afghanistan are the worst anywhere in the world. Only 18% of women in Afghanistan are literate at this point, after this so-called progress. So I think, unfortunately, this is war propaganda. It was used at the time of the launch of the war, and it's now being used to desperately try and justify the unjustifiable. And to try and pretend that what has happened in Afghanistan was anything other than an absolute disaster. So, you know, I don't think we should allow the people who support the war to get away with this kind of nonsense. They also talk about economic progress. Look at the World Bank statistics. Look at the UN statistics. There has been no economic progress in Afghanistan in the last 20 years. In fact, most indexes suggest that it's gone backwards, which is not surprising, because that's what happens when you bombard a country with a huge amount of munitions and send troops rampaging through the streets of towns and cities. You know, this isn't a particularly sensible economic strategy.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
But even the average American, they've also lost in this war, and not only because the politicians use them like cannon fodder, sending them off to die or get their legs blown off in exchange for some medal. On average, there are 22 veterans committing suicide every day. Something clearly wrong going on here. And the irony in all of this is that Americans who thought they were delivering democracy and freedom to others lost their own freedom and democracy. Under their very noses, U.S. politicians were passing things like the Patriot Act, warrantless wiretapping, or the president's surveillance program, signed barely 24 hours after 9/11 by then Vice President Dick Cheney. They started a mass surveillance program to spy on you in the name of fighting terrorism. And it doesn't stop there. Just look at Guantanamo Bay. One of the most horrific consequences of the war on terror is without a doubt Guantanamo Bay. The Bush administration set up this prison on occupied Cuban territory and has used it to kidnap Muslim men from around the world, bring them there and hold them without charge or trial. One of the men who was taken to Guantanamo Bay is Mansour al-Daifi from Yemen. He was never charged with any crime, never mind convicted of a crime. An innocent man, he was kept in Guantanamo Bay for 14 years and only freed recently in 2016. Now he is an activist and a CAGE Guantanamo Project coordinator. He's also just released a book titled Don't Forget Us Here, detailing his time in Guantanamo. Hello, Mansour. Thank you so much for coming on the program. Mansour, for those who are not familiar with your story, with what you had to endure, could you tell us who you are, what you did before you were detained and taken to Guantanamo Bay, and how you ended up being there?
I am Mansour Daifi. Now I am holding also a number 441, because also this is my number. I think I own it. I pay 15 years for it. I am from Yemen, where I was, as you know, like, I lived for around 18 years. I grew up in, was raised in a very conservative family. I finished my high school in Yemen. Then I went to Afghanistan for a research mission. Only after a few months, I was ambushed by warlord, sold to the CIA for bounty money, imprisoned in the black site, then shipped to Guantanamo.
So a warlord just wanted some money from the CIA.
As you know, when American invaded Afghanistan in 2001, they were throwing flyers offering large bounty of money for anyone who hand over foreigners or Afghanis. So according to the ACLU, that 86% of the Tunisians at Guantanamo were either mistaken identity or sold for bounty. People think that people at Guantanamo, they were captured in the battlefield. No, that wasn't the case. That wasn't the case. Now, only the research proved that only 8% who has ties to Al-Qaeda or Taliban.
Right. So that's out of several hundred, right?
Out of 800. I mean, the United States wanted to send a message to the world. They can go beyond any laws. They won't abide by any law or agreements. So they created Guantanamo outside of the law, baseless legal place. Also, at the same time, Guantanamo is a military prison within a military base. It's like a black hole. So they said federal law doesn't apply in Guantanamo. Kobia law doesn't apply. Geneva Convention doesn't apply. So it's outside of the law. So they can do whatever they want. There is no accountability for what happened there. The youngest detainee was only a few months old. The oldest was 105 years old, to that extent.
What's the one common denominator between everyone who's detained there? You're just Muslim.
Yeah, I mean, yes, like all of us